when I could sort of take a touch of hand on this day, I found very interesting the part of your paper you talk about space, and I have often wondered whether, in a way, another angle in upon all of this is to look at the history of, and perhaps to try and outgrow the history of the seminar, which has become this sort of standard sort of spatial arrangement, in a sense, pedagogical arrangement.
Yeah.
I mean, you can only, in a sense, have this concept, and that's very much what you're saying, this concept of kind of meaningful encounter, if you've got this sort of 1950s seminar notion and so on.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you've thought about, you know, maybe, I mean, just as a sort of purely theoretical exercise, what would happen if we didn't have seminars inside universities at all?
Mm.
And what would happen if we actually looked back at, say, some of the different ways, you know, particularly in relation to art practice, the way that art teaching was conducted, you know, in days when, for example, you know, institutions like universities were not particularly engaged with any of this stuff. I mean, I suppose ultimately I'm heading to into the territory of suggesting, you know, well, I must admit this is where I'm beginning to think at the moment, is that I'm really ceasing to be convinced that the modern university, you know, in Australia or America, or perhaps at some case in America or the UK, actually any longer really are viable places for the teaching of, you know, interesting practices, including interesting historical practices in relation to art and writing.
Yeah.
And it's because, in a way, this the real reason the back of it is because of all our, you know, wonderful liberal kind of dissemination ideas, and our ideas like the seminar, the seedbed, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we've just got to kind of break through this stuff.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, that the spatial question is one that is so often ignored in thinking about universities, other than, you know, in that real horrible flipped kind of modes and all this kind of stuff. But
I just always think of like when a cockroach goes from being upside down in a bath to suddenly scuffling away. It's just like
how does blended learning fit into that?
Oh, I don't even like. Yeah, we get terrorized by the flippers and benders because we have such a big course, and it's always like
it's always been encroached on by.
But it's so like they approach it so disingenuously. They're like, we want to trial flipping and blending in your class because you have because we want to do it. We want to start out with a small group and then work bigger. And I'm like, so why did you literally choose the biggest course then? It's like because they just want to flip us so hard because we have 3 hours of like vague time, and that's like an extraordinary expense in a weird way, even though it's also an extraordinary revenue, that it's like, what could 3 hours of like capital time mean to the flippers and blenders? Like, we could just record ourselves for 20 minutes and curate materials, and then that, like, that could be the 26 3-hour concurrent class, you know, like, and which, yeah.
But that's what they mean by flipping and blending. It's like, we have 3 hours of this revenue, but actually we only want 1 hour, 2 hours
of flavour.
But I agree, and I think, however, that the default position is trying to hold on to the seminar space against online learning and kind of this blended kind of stuff. It's like, no, we must hold on to the seminar space. I think it'd be really more interesting to say, like, well, if we are going to think about new models of spatial learning and teaching, which is really only dominated by online modes of learning and teaching right now, like, what are some other models that we could encounter?
Yeah, there has to be other ones. Yeah. I always think, like, I always feel bad that I have this very six-step, what I imagine to be, without any sort of knowledge to back this up, like a kind of 16th century, like, scholastic model where I roam around and sort of trip over and I just speak, like, athletically for an hour, and just, and people interject when they like feel like they want to rebel.
You are aware that's
what you do already. No, I'm saying that's what I do.
Okay.
And sometimes I think like, oh, I should be more seminary, but I find it hard to do that. And then I think like, it can't just be that it's like the 16th century, the seminar, or the flip. Like, there has to be something else, but I don't know what it is. Like, the best conversations I have, like, I'm sure we all agree, like, the best ones are the ones where you encounter the student somewhere and you have a discussion, and it's really normal and exciting, and yeah. But I don't know.
But that's similarly what.
Isn't the structure of the seminar, or like, you know, this kind of, this, what seems like a conservative, or like anti-progressive, or like Luddite style anti-technological thing. Like, isn't that one of the only things that's good about university to some degree?
Absolutely.
Access to networked objects is fully policed. There's
signs
up on the wall that say, like, I remember when there was the at UNSW, and we saw Heather Love speak recently. Yeah. They have those signs up on the wall that say, like, no cell phones, and it looks hilarious. I mean, it looks like something out of grade school. It's right smoking. I find that really great. Like, isn't introducing technology in the classroom the shittiest thing to some degree?
No, absolutely. And that's
reproduce that.
There's so much pressure to do it.
There's a body of literature like Bernard Stiegler, which seems really conservative, articulating a similar kind of pedagogical instinct. But yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree, and I think that you may, like, one is made to feel uncertain about that when they do it, like if you go in and you just sort of putz around. But I do think that it makes for, like, I certainly think in my experience it's the only way I can do it, because that sort of like mediated and facilitated and tech heavy delivery, just I can't do it convincingly. Like, no one's gonna listen to me if I'm sort of poking around and like coming in and out of windows and trying, you know, like. Like, I just look like a fool. I'm much more convincing when I'm just talking at speed, and I think that's probably... And to me, and... Yeah, I don't know. Who knows?
You don't very often have to sit down and listen to someone speak for a long time.
Mm.
You know, I mean, that is the seminar model to some degree, no?
Well, I think the seminar model is kind of predicated on the assumption that speaking is a more decentralized activity for the most part, right? Is that what you mean by seminar,
yeah,
or do you mean...
Yes, I do, and I think it's... Yeah, it is, and it's based on some sort of concept, I think not very clearly worked out concept, of a sort of, you know, mutuality of engaged conversation or something of that kind, and the notion that somehow, you know, it's a good thing to be able to vocalise and verbalise and these sorts of things. And often I think, well, I don't want to be hard line on this, but I see certain... really, you know, advantages within it. But what would happen if you did imagine models which just got rid of the seminar?
Mm.
I mean, for example, if you said, well, you know, if you look back at the history, it's a 1950s American teaching tool, basically. Mm. And certainly in those days, back, you know, so 50s and 60s, students were actually assessed on their capacity to participate in the seminar. I mean, you know, that if you didn't vocalise, then you actually would get a, you know, bad grade at the end of it in that particular section of the assessment, and so on and so forth. That was going on at Columbia, for example, in the 60s. But what would happen, for example, if you said, well, let's not do seminars. Let's say, you know, that every week there's an exhibition.
Mm.
You know, let's say that, you know, every sort of group of students form their own atelier, you know, and the atelier is not necessarily based inside the university. I mean, you know, I mean that would be bliss to the ears of the administrators here.
Yeah.
You know, basically, you know,
outsourced.
Rest of building out.
Really
careful. You know, these monsters, you know, the tools that they need. But I mean, there is some sense in which I feel that we have kind of lost, in a way, some sense of the connectedness that there is between the arts as practices, but also between sort of the role of practitioners to be both practitioners and to some degree, you know, pedagogues. I mean, you know, I've often wondered what would it be like, for example, to go to Gustave Moreau's studio. One of the great places of teaching and learning, it seems to me, that's ever existed, sort of, you know, certainly in some years, you know, filled with the most remarkable students and so on.
Mm.
What was it like to be in that place?
Mm.
It must have been, presumably, you actually did. You walked into part of the artist's studio. You can see it now. You can go there. It's sort of, it's a tourist exhibition in a sense at the moment. But, you know, maybe sometimes we need to kind of have a look at some of these older ways that people did things. And again, get a sort of different relationship of negotiation between the university and our practices. And then the last thing is, I'll shut up, but obviously what I'm also getting at here is that I also feel that it's gone on in this university, and you just have to walk around the corner and see the sort of incredible building site and all the rest of it. we are all working in these mega institutions.
Mm.
You know, we're not working in places that I think any longer have the sort of the dynamics of the small, of the small and the engaged and the sort of the really interesting, and you know, like we're working in these kind of, you know, they are, I mean, I don't mean to be too rude about it, but they are just cold supermarkets of one-way teaching. That's what they are, that's what they've become.
Yeah.